Hello there. Today is Friday, April 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. charges WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange after his arrest in London.
I've just been with Mr. Assange in the police cells. He wants to thank all of his supporters for their ongoing support, and he said, "I told you so."
President Trump says he's willing to meet with North Korea's leader for a third summit. Also ahead, pop star Mariah Carey is about to get a big award at the upcoming Billboard Music Awards. It's all on today's International Edition. The United States has charged WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange in a computer hacking conspiracy linked to the release of hundreds of thousands of secret U.S. documents just hours after British police dramatically arrested him at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he'd been holed up for nearly 7 years. VOA's Jeff Custer reports from Washington.
London police, invited to the embassy by Ecuador's ambassador, literally carried Assange out and took him into custody Thursday. Assange was arrested for violating a June 2012 British warrant. But the U.S. indictment stems from one of the largest breaches of classified information in U.S. history. In 2010, WikiLeaks released a vast cache of U.S. military records from its wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that documented civilian casualties. It also contained the assessments of suspected terrorists held by the United States at its prison in Guantanamo, Cuba, and 250,000 secret State Department cables. The U.S. accused Assange of conspiring with former U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning to access U.S. Defense Department computers. Speaking Thursday in London, Assange's lawyer, Jennifer Robinson, insisted Assange was a working journalist and the United States is persecuting him for doing his job.
"This sets a dangerous precedent for all media organizations and journalists in Europe and elsewhere around the world. This precedent means that any journalist can be extradited for prosecution in the United States for having published truthful information about the United States."
But U.S. prosecutors focused on Assange's conspiring to illegally access top-secret information, not its publication. Actions not covered by U.S. laws protecting press freedoms. London police confirmed Assange was arrested in relation to an extradition warrant on behalf of the United States. Assange's lawyers say they will fight that extradition. Jeff Custer, VOA News, Washington.
Well, asked about it on Thursday during a meeting with South Korea's leader at the White House, President Trump said he wasn't involved in the Assange arrest.
"I know there is something having to do with Julian Assange. I've been seeing what's happened with Assange, and that will be a determination, I would imagine, mostly by the Attorney General, who's doing an excellent job. So he'll be making a determination. I know nothing really about him. It's not my deal in life."
But the president's comments are in contrast to things he said when he was campaigning against Hillary Clinton in 2016.
"The Hillary Clinton documents released today by WikiLeaks make more clear than ever just how much is at stake in this election. So much corruption."
U.S. lawmakers on both sides of the political aisle are mostly reacting positively to Assange's arrest. Here's Democratic Senator Mark Warner.
"They've acted in concert with the Russians to interfere in our elections. They helped either hack into or took hacked information from the Russians and released it in a way to disrupt our campaigns in 2016. And I don't think that's not right. I think that's illegal, and I hope Mr. Assange gets prosecuted."
And in rare bipartisan agreement, here's Republican Senator John Kennedy.
"He's under indictment, and I'm pleased to see him arrested. I can't speak for the president's comments, I haven't heard. But we have due process in this country. I'll have a chance to defend myself."
Well, the Australian-born WikiLeaks executive has cast himself as a whistleblower, a portrayal his attorney sought to underscore. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The Vatican is holding a spiritual retreat for peace in South Sudan. Violence in Libya could give ISIS renewed opportunities. China's president receives the first African honorary doctorate. And a startup incubator aims to spawn companies to fight climate change. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Sudan's defense minister's announcement of removing President Omar al-Bashir and forming a military transitional council to run the country for 2 years is causing some Africa experts to fear that Sudan might end up adopting the Egyptian model of the 2013 model that derailed a real transition toward democracy. Judd Devermont, director of the Center for Strategic and International Studies Africa Program, spoke with VOA's senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy about the consequences of repeating the Egyptian model and what he thinks might be a better transition alternative.
I think that the Sudanese government would like to follow the Egyptian model, but I'm not sure that they're going to get there just yet. Whether the government intended to or not, this is an opening salvo. And the street and the protest movement and the Sudanese Professional Association have made it very clear that these are unacceptable terms and they will stay on the street. So I think the next couple of days and weeks are going to be very tense as we see the street try to demonstrate that they are not leaving and they want a full removal of the regime. And the military, for its part, is going to try to show that they have momentum and that they are capable of using force to impose this transition.
Could that lead to a violent collision between the protesters and the army?
Yes, I think that is a very likely scenario. The key variable here is going to be parts of the security service that had already aligned with the street, whether we're talking about the soldiers who were defending the protesters or the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, and the police that said they weren't going to intervene in peaceful demonstrations. And so right now there's a bidding war between the military under the defense minister and the protesters for the loyalty of those specific security officials.
But usually the political system under a dictator lacks democratic institutions that can pave the way for a peaceful transition toward democracy. Is that the case in Sudan?
I think for Sudan, there is a way through this transition, which is not exactly what the military is going to want and not in what the protesters are going to want, which is that they are going to need to have a transitional government that is mixed, that includes some of the professional associations and the Sudanese intelligentsia that have been behind the protests. And it's going to have to necessarily include some of the military, some of the NCP and the technocrats. That's a good compromise because everyone is going to be unhappy with it. But I think you need some of that continuity to run the government. At the same time, this protest and this transition is the product of these protesters and the people of Sudan speaking up for their legitimate right to shape their government. And that is probably the best way for an autocracy like Sudan to move forward.
That's Judd Devermont, director of the Center for Strategic and International Studies Africa Program, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy. Sitting alongside South Korea's president, U.S. President Donald Trump expressed willingness Thursday to hold another summit with North Korea's leader to try to reach a sweeping denuclearization deal. But some analysts say North Korea might begin turning away from South Korean President Moon Jae-in after he failed to secure sanctions relief from President Trump during his visit to the White House. Moon, who has made improving ties with North Korea and resuming inter-Korean projects central elements of his presidency, met with Trump in an attempt to reinvigorate denuclearization talks between Washington and Pyongyang, which have been deadlocked since the breakdown of the Hanoi summit held by Trump and Kim in February. VOA Asia's Ira Melman gets an update from White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman on whether the meeting garnered any progress.
Well, there were no major announcements that have come out of this meeting. Reporters were allowed in the Oval Office at the start of the meeting between President Trump and President Moon. And the president did take a number of questions from reporters on this topic and others. Most notable, perhaps, was the president was asked whether he'd be willing to accept something short of a sweeping denuclearization deal if he held another summit, which would be a third one, with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. And he said there are various smaller deals that could happen short of denuclearization. He said you could work it out step by step in pieces. But at the moment, we're talking about the big deal. And the big deal is you have to get rid of the nuclear weapon. So and Moon Jae-in also agreed that that is the goal. So there is agreement still between Seoul and Washington that denuclearization is still the objective here.
And apparently what the North Koreans want right now is some kind of lessening, if not the full erasure of the sanctions that have been placed against them, correct?
Right. And Trump was asked about sanctions, and what he said is he had decided not to toughen them, but that he wants the existing sanctions to remain in place until there is this a big deal. So there is still a fundamental difference between the United States and North Korea.
And President Trump still had very positive things to say about the leader of North Korea, did he not?
Right. He did express good wishes to Kim Jong-un and the people of North Korea. We've had him say that a number of times, and that indicates that he still has a positive view about the possibility of something being reached, and we're not headed back, at least rhetoric-wise, from the White House, a return to that era of threats of fire and fury, as we heard at the beginning of the Trump administration.
The South Koreans seem to be going on a particularly different highway on this, really hoping to open up more cooperation with their northern neighbors.
Sure. And I think behind the scenes, there is a bit more disagreement than we saw between Trump and Moon sitting in those yellow seats in the Oval Office on Thursday. The fact is that Seoul and Washington are apart on a number of important issues between them. Seoul, of course, wanting to lessen sanctions on the North. There's also that big question of how much the South Koreans should pay for hosting U.S. troops on the Korean Peninsula. Moon and Trump have differing views on the assertiveness of China. And also, the United States is very frustrated in the intelligence community and at the Pentagon because of a lack of military and intelligence cooperation between the Japanese and the South Koreans, vis-a-vis the North Koreans and the Chinese.
Not everyone is getting along well, are they?
Well, that has been the case in East Asia for a long time. And what South Korean President Moon noted today in the Oval Office, he gave a lot of credit to Trump, saying that since that first summit in Singapore, that there is a mood of a peace now, and tensions have significantly lessened. The question is how long do we remain in this particular phase and what that leads to next?
That's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell Thursday called for bipartisan talks aimed at bolstering asylum laws and addressing border security amid a surge of migrants crossing the southwest border with Mexico and daily outcries by President Trump about the need to clamp down on immigration. McConnell's statement underscored the political pressures facing lawmakers amid a steady diet of news reports about federal agencies being overwhelmed by the sheer numbers of people trying to enter the U.S. from Mexico. Trump has already shaken up his team atop the Department of Homeland Security, complained that asylum laws are too lax, and asserted that the country is full. By international law, though, nations are supposed to let asylum seekers stay in their countries if they have legitimate specific fears of persecution or danger if they return home. The U.S. Border Patrol said it apprehended more than 92,000 people at the U.S.-Mexico border in March, and that included just over 53,000 who were parents and children traveling together. Joining us to discuss all of this is Christopher Wilson, Deputy Director of the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. Chris, what do you make of all the things the president has been saying about tightening things up here?
The president is extraordinarily frustrated that the numbers of migrants continue to go up despite their best efforts to be tough and strong on border security. I think that's evidence that it's not just about sort of the U.S. response, but there are really significant push factors from the countries in Central America that are one of the main causes of the spike in migration. There may be other innovations in smuggling methods, express bus routes being opened up through Mexico, changes in Mexico's immigration policy that are now being reversed. And in short, there's a lot going on. But I think that the president is just very frustrated that the crisis is not easy to stem. This is actually a very complex issue. The challenge here, though, for him, I think, is that I don't know that there are a whole lot of other good options on the table. I don't think that doing something the courts have already ruled against is a very good option in terms of separating children from their families, nor am I convinced that that necessarily would work anyway in terms of creating a deterrent effect. We also have to take into consideration what type of Secretary of Homeland Security can be confirmed by the Senate. I think that's definitely a constraining factor. Someone like Commissioner McAleenan, who will serve as acting director of Homeland Security, who is respected by moderates within the president's own party, that may not be willing to support someone who is considered much more radical on issues of immigration and border security.
We heard last week that the president, after days of threatening to close the border and advisors warning him against that, that apparently he was telling staffers that he really didn't care about the economic consequences. He wanted them to close parts of the border. Somehow that didn't happen. I'm not sure. We're not sure why it didn't happen, but it sounds like he was serious, that he really wanted to do that. What about that? Would that do anything to deter people?
Well, there's two potential justifications for closing parts of the border or the entire border. One of them is to gain leverage over Mexico, try to convince Mexico to do more to stop the flow of migrants. In that sense, I think the order of events is quite odd because about a week ago, before these threats of border closure started to be issued, Mexico had already agreed, actually after meeting with Secretary Nielsen in Miami, to change its policies to be much tougher on migration. Mexico has been sort of experimenting with a more open, welcoming approach, trying to document as many Central Americans moving through Mexico as possible, regularize them, give them visas. But they're backing off some of that, and they're trying to now find a more balanced approach that, yes, seeks to protect migrants, but also is more careful not to provoke a large wave of migrants. So in terms of a threat with Mexico and pushing them to do more, I think Mexico is already doing a lot and is at the table. I think Mexico is willing to do whatever they can to work with the United States to deal with this crisis. That frankly, is a crisis for Mexico as well. Mexico also has shelters that are full. Mexico also has a system that is struggling to keep up with the large numbers of migrants coming through from Central America and through Mexico.
It would appear that the president does not want us to believe that this is predominantly a humanitarian crisis, which is mostly involving families.
This is absolutely predominantly a humanitarian crisis. There's just really no question about that. When people are not seeking to sneak into the United States, but are rather presenting themselves before U.S. authorities, that's not a traditional border security crisis. In fact, most of these migrants would prefer to show up at a port of entry and present themselves in a wholly legal fashion, but we've instituted a policy known as metering that limits the number of people that can seek asylum at a port of entry each day. And so migrants, therefore, need to do what's called having defensive asylum claims, meaning they cross the border illegally and then make a credible fear claim or a claim that they would fear being returned to their home country and are processed for asylum. This is a crisis. The system is overwhelmed. There are huge humanitarian issues. There are fundamental border security issues in the sense of our immigration system not functioning with this new type of immigration in the way that it needs to, but it's not a traditional border security crisis mm-hmm. that could be solved with a wall, certainly, but not even with sort of the traditional measures that we employed against single men migrating from Mexico to the United States for most of the economic reasons during the last decade. We're really facing a whole new reality, and we need a new approach to it, and we need new capacities in our immigration system. We need more immigration judges. We need more people who can, you know, process these credible fear interviews. We need capacity and shelters to deal with migrant children and families that shelters were not designed for. We need a lot. There is a crisis, but it's not a traditional border security crisis.
All right. That's Christopher Wilson, Deputy Director of the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. As scientists get better at sifting through our past, more and more variations of human beings are turning up in archaeological digs. In the early 2000s, there was the discovery in Indonesia of a tiny hominid called Flores Man. And now this week, an archaeologist says he's found the remains of another human cousin buried in a Philippine cave. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
These bones, sitting next to the skulls of other human ancestors, are among the remains of three individuals that may add a new chapter to the Book of Humanity. Archaeologist Armand Mijares found the bones in a cave on a small Philippine island and says they are between 50 and 67,000 years old. By studying the collection that include bones from the foot and the femur, the bone that links the knee and the hip, and a selection of teeth, Mijares slowly came to the conclusion these bones may not be just ancient human bones, but a new species.
At the time, we say probably a small-bodied Homo sapien in 2010. But now, in 2011, we got more, and in 2015, we have no a good collection. And I think it's diagnostic enough. The elements are good enough to be able to provide us features to say it is a new species.
The creature was small. Its scientific name is Homo luzonensis, and while it was certainly indigenous to the region, Mijares says it didn't die in the cave.
This creature did not die there. It was actually washed into the cave. So they were actually not using the cave. They were just wandering around the vehicle of the cave and probably died there, and through time, all the bones are being washed into the cave. So we don't exactly know what are related and how to reconstruct it fully.
Mijares also doesn't know what ultimately happened to the species, but says the arrival of the larger, more robust humans may have led to its extinction. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
No artist has more number one hits on the Billboard Hot 100 chart than Mariah Carey. So it's only fitting that the singer will receive the Icon Award at the 2019 Billboard Music Awards. NBC and Dick Clark Productions announced Thursday that the Grammy-winning superstar will also be performing at the event. Carey has 18 number one hits. Her duet with Boyz II Men, One Sweet Day, spent 16 weeks at number one, making it the longest-running number one hit on the Hot 100 chart. Kelly Clarkson will host the Billboard Awards, which is being held on May 1st in Las Vegas. Cardi B leads with 21 nominations. Well, you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. I'm
hold it right here. Cause we gonna smooth it out. Come on. MC. And she won't stop.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has sworn in Ilhan Karr as the United States Special Envoy to monitor and combat anti-Semitism. In that role, he will advise Secretary Pompeo on policies and programs concerning anti-Semitism and will represent the U.S. abroad on the issue. Special Envoy Carr defined anti-Semitism as hostility toward or prejudice against Jews, either the Jewish people or the Jewish religion. He said it manifests itself in many forms. It can be denying or minimizing the Holocaust. It could be acts of violence against Jews. It can be attacks on Jewish institutions. It can be demonization of the State of Israel or the denial of the Jewish people its right to self-determination in its ancient homeland. Special Envoy Carr noted that criticism of Israel, just like criticism of the United States, is entirely acceptable. However, the criticism has to be fair, he cautioned.
For example, if Israel is criticized for exercising its inalienable right to defend itself from the onslaught coming from Gaza or from Hezbollah, then that's a double standard. And a double standard is not fair criticism of Israel. A double standard is defined as anti-Semitism.
Today, anti-Semitism is also a component in terrorism and extremism, said Special Envoy Carr.
We find actually that many terrorist organizations, those on the far left, those on the far right, those coming from radical Islam, adopt anti-Semitism as a core defining feature of those movements, which is why it's so important to fight anti-Semitism. Fighting anti-Semitism isn't only about protecting the Jewish people, but fighting anti-Semitism is a way to make the world a better place.
Indeed, anti-Semitism can be viewed as history's greatest barometer of human suffering, noted Mr. Carr. Every society that has embraced anti-Semitism has rotted to its core and produced human suffering at a level that defies description. We certainly saw that in Nazi Germany, but also throughout history, observed Mr. Carr. So fighting anti-Semitism, stressed Special Envoy Carr, is a moral obligation that we have not only for the Jewish people, but for our countries, for our societies, for our continents, and for the kind of world we want our children to inherit.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA.